Okay, good morning. Today is Thursday, September 21, 2023. I'm still in northern Thailand, and the river hasn't flooded, and the rain is slowly... we had a day without rain yesterday, which was the first day, perhaps in the whole 10 days that I've been here or so, where it hadn't rained, where there wasn't rain, which was nice. I hadn't really had a particular topic in mind to talk of today when I'm in a place like this. I'm not really focused on problems that would be valuably addressed or phenomena for which a presentation could be structured, something like that. This is jungle life or forest life, elephants and some creatures across the river. It looks like a wild boar, wild pig, dark color. It's about 2 feet long and about 2 feet high, and it was not a baby elephant, it's a baby boar. What a boar. So, what I have been noticing, or a number of, this will be kind of free form for anybody who enjoys that, or for me, and hopefully you enjoy it. Sitting at the river, the sitting room that views the river has windows on three sides. To the right, I can see the river coming. Straight forward, I see the river as a portion of moving liquid right in front of me, kind of straight forward, straight ahead. To the left, then I see it going away. And I thought first, you know, which would be the better view? In the end, I thought the way this house is, the structure, this room and this place, the view of it, of the water receding, rushing away, leaving me, the departing view, the view of Shiva rather than the view of Brahma or Vishnu, not generating, coming in, not preserving or continuing straight in front of me, but declining, dissolving, passing away, arising, persisting, passing away, the passing away view to the left, watching it go away, is perhaps for me the best view here. What does that mean? Well, it struck me about life that, you know, we talk about impermanence, anitya, all the time. The opposite of nitya, nityananda, being not permanent, not impermanent or permanent, ananda. But you know, we know all phenomena arise, persist, pass away. That's stable. The only certainty in knowing is that there's a certainty that our knowing is incomplete. There's a certainty that phenomena cannot be grasped. There's a certainty that what arises passes away, or whatever passes away has arisen. There is no comfortable view. There is no ideal view in a realm of impermanence. To the degree that we're viewing phenomena as impermanent, are they impermanent? Well, depends on your doors of perception. So on the one hand, watching the river come at me, even though it's not coming at me physically, it's physically in front of me, but it's coming on down towards me, in front of me, That feels like an assault. Watching the river in front of me, just passing, feels sort of ungraspable. There's nothing there. I'm looking at a point, but the point keeps shifting, it seems. And looking at the departing view, or to the left, feels a little sad of the mild dukkha of inevitable loss. So there's actually no good view in the realms of impermanence. But the realms of impermanence, is impermanence of the object or of the subject? Of course it's of the subject. And the object is of the subject too. Meaning all is one, right? The law of one. Meaning so-called outer and so-called inner is the result of distortion. Without distortion, presumably, there'd be a recognition that outer and inner is one. That's exactly what jhana, the first step in awakening, I'd say, in Advaita Vedanta, is all about. Like Nityananda said, the yoni no longer sees himself as in the world, but the world as in himself. So the outer or other is known as the self, but the self is therefore not a separate thing. There's no identity. There's no separative identity for the yoni, or in the view of unity, because that outer, known as of I, of an inner, means that there's no longer an outer and an inner. There's no longer an outer, or there's no longer an inner when there's no longer an outer. When the outer is known as a manifestation of the seer. It's not that there's nothing happening but the seer. There is something happening. There is something happening other than the seer, except for the seer is everything. And so the seer is inner outer. And when the outer is recognized to the degree it's recognized as of the seer, of the inner, then there's no more inner or outer. There's just the one field of life where there's the appearance of change. And there is this intrinsically mysterious, indefinable, inconceivable, achinteya, seer, observer, knower, I, that sees and says. The I that sees and says, visual or hearing, seeing and hearing, the I with a capital I for Irving, that sees and hears and cognizes and perceives and formulates so-called phenomenal experience, apparently in change, that is a mystery. You know, the nature of the seer is a mystery. And I don't have a problem with Advaita Vedanta talking about self, self, self all the time, because the self is real, is in that system, for those who really understand it, I'd say, understood as not localized to a body and not separate from totality. Self-realization, therefore, is the first step of... Oh, hello. Huh. The longer I stay, the more little creatures draw near. I just had a bird. And here, Thailand is wild. Taiwan, everybody's kind of domesticated, including some of the creatures. They're kind of mellow. But here, it's kind of wild, really wild. And just had a bird saying hello. So different creatures come and go as one establishes one's forest credentials. But in Advaita Vedanta, the self that is realized is recognized by those teaching as not localized to the body and not separate from totality. It's just the first step in realizing totality is to realize the subset called self, which then is known as the projector or creator, co-creator of a so-called outer, or what we call outer, is co-created by what it is and the seer, yet the seer is all that it is. The seer is all there is. You know, look around, you see the creator, said Ra. Everything's Brahma, right? It's all, display of light. You're not living in a material universe. You're dancing thoughts. The you that is definition of identity. The you are a dancing thought. What do you mean you? What do you mean? Fuck you. What do you mean you are a dancing thought? What's the I? Light is a dancing thought. Identity within boundless light is a dancing thought. In some sense, yeah. The formulation that I is this identity associated with this body-mind-spirit complex, that formulation of I is a thought, is based in thought, is based in deep mind contraction or distortion in the deep mind of a contractive nature that coalesces an inner and an outer. That there's no inner outer without that distortion of eighth fetter or the, you know, ahamkar. That is an add-on. It's dispensable. It's optional. You know, the logos doesn't have personal identity, nor does the river. Reality is, but to the extent that we've defined it as I'm the subject and everything I'm seeing, hearing is an object, then yeah, that self is a dancing thought. And the universe is not material other than our definitions and experience of materiality as opposed to what? Immateriality? Do we even know what that is? So I look at the river and I realize, actually, if I'm seeing impermanence, there's no good view. If I'm looking at it coming at me, I'm assaulted. If I look at it right in front of me, it's seriously ungraspable and not satisfying in a sense. If I stabilize seeing it departing and going away, it's the sadness of all mutable things passing away. And there's a sense of late afternoon sunset. You know, looking at the departing river, it's always leaving. Phenomena that arise always depart and die or end. But that's not the whole of it. There's another way of looking at the river that I could see, which is that it's a single body in motion. It's a single body that appears to be in motion. It's a single body undulating. It's a single field and single body of what I call water that has a certain color that appears to be moving, or things in it. It as many is moving. It as one is undulating in the course of the riverbed in different ways depending on perspective. When I turn to the right, it's undulating in the way of approach. When I turn to the left, it's undulating in the way of departure. Now that can be, one can think that and get a sense of what I mean, but there's an experience of it too, which is that the river is no longer seen as a composite of little water droplets and wavelets and rivulets that are moving, changing, shifting, ever-changing, shifting from right to middle to left. Yeah, it's no longer seen quite that way. It's seen as unmoving, undulating. Now, maybe if I was at a higher level, I wouldn't see undulating. Who knows? But arising, persisting, and passing isn't change from a non-dual perspective as much as one can sense it. As much as one knows, or I know, I mean, the speaker hopefully has some experience of these things. As much as I know the non-dual, phenomena are not really fully known by the perspective of impermanence. That's a deeper understanding to the common, but it's not the end of the line to perceive impermanence, actually. Because there's a certain quality to that which appears impermanent that is not impermanent. And this, you know, I was thinking about Heraclitus also, reading. I brought with me a book translated, Heraclitus Fragments, translated by a poet, Brooks Haxton. Brooks Haxton has a cool name and maybe a cool dude, maybe. But he thinks that Heraclitus' use of the word logos has to do with linguistics or language. The importance of word language, because he's a poet. Well, I don't think so, because Heraclitus was talking about logos in the Greek sense of logos, not in the poetical sense of the importance of language and word, physical words. But despite that, and he basically translated the phrase, the fragment that says something like, seekers of gold must dig up much dirt, to those who seek an ounce of gold must dig a ton of dirt. Well, that's cute, but Heraclitus didn't say ounce or ton, and it's lame to put those in, but this is what translators do. They basically territorialize or territorially co-opt the source and make it their own. So, but Heraclitus did say, and Haxton was honest enough to put it, that there was a fragment, something like, eyes and ears and mind in action, this is what I value. Something like that. And I think most likely that's an accurate, more or less accurate transliteration. Where Heraclitus is really saying, the eyes and the ears and mind in action, I value that. Well, the eyes receive visual image. The ears receive auditory signal. Huh. Both eyes and ears are very receptive, are receptive. In fact, they're more receptive than transmissive. You can give, you know, throw him a glare, throw a look, like blue steel. Zoolander throws the blue steel look. Like that kind of. You can't see my face, but I did my best. So Zoolander throws the blue steel look, but really the eyes are more receptive than transmissive. Likewise, the ears are more receptive than transmissive. The mouth, of course, you know, don't get me started on seven chakra symbolism. But the mouth is receptive to the physical, you know, nutriments of food, and transmissive to the mind's thought by speech. So the mind transmits speech, which is a vocalization, the voc of manas, is vocalized, or speech comes out of the mouth. That's what's transmitted by the mouth, is the mind. And what comes into the mouth is supportive for the body. So the mouth is really, really important, in the same way that second chakra is the basis of the whole show for self-conscious beings. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 chakras, the middle five is where it's at, where the work is done. And the basis of the middle five is 2. So the root chakra of self-consciousness is second chakra, if you want to get cutesy about it. So, okay, eyes, heart chakra, ears, fifth chakra, you know, so 4 and 5, 5.4, 5.5, 5.4 is ears, 5 is eyes, 5.5 is ears. The fourth and fifth chakra in the head, or the fourth and fifth chakra in general, are particularly receptive. Yes, Ra said Blu-ray, fifth ray, wisdom, fifth ray associated with the ears, is the first chakra that's outgoing as well as incoming. So actually all the chakras are incoming other than 5 and 6, which are both. But 5 comes out through the mouth, and mouth is second chakra related to 5.2. So fifth chakra comes out by 5.2, But its basis is 5.4, 5.5, meaning what the eyes see and what the ears hear. The receptive functions of 4 and 5, the eyes and the ears. And Heraclitus, you know, for whatever criticisms one can have of him, which anyone would have, because he's not finished, I'm not finished, you're not finished, but like a pure adept, he really understood the importance of receptivity, reception. In like Einstein saying, imagination is more important than knowledge. Because what's the basis of new knowledge? New, cutting edge, breaking envelopes, or the leading edge into the new of knowledge commonly comes by imagination. Dreaming the possible, one may perceive the previously unrecognized extant, hidden, the hidden extant, E-X-T-A-N-T. Bailey likes the word extant. It means existent, existing. What exists, what is, not yet perceived, still is. The way of knowing is perceiving that which is, but yet as yet hidden. The extant yet hidden. I mean, all of reality that we don't know, or all that we ought to be knowing, is real, but not yet known and hidden, thus hidden or unseen. That's all known by eyes and ears and the mind in action. The way of learning, and the basis of growth is learning, and the basis of learning is the eyes and ears and the mind in action, just like Heraclitus said, despite Brooks Haxton, actually. Eyes and ears and mind in action, this is what I value. And actually, people who love Advaita Vedanta and love Buddhism and love the raw material, particularly loving Eastern traditions, Buddhist, Hindu, may or may not use the eye and ear and mind in action adequately. Or we're all learning. Meaning, actually, just going to silence of mind at steady state, silence of self, Ross said, I think, better silence of mind at a steady state, meaning samadhi, samadhi, meaning quiet mind, not too much sankhara arising, not too much interest in thinking, feeling, me and me. The caravan of me and me takes a rest. Me and me. That's a funny way of putting it, I know, but actually, that's how fraudulent identity is conceived and maintained, by a continual stream of self-referentiality, which is basically me and me. I and my thoughts, I and my body, I and my future, I and my day, I and my reflection on I and my day, I and I is not the same as me and me. The Rastafari knows the truth is I and I, but it seems to me we're stuck in me and me. I, me, mine is possessive identity, referential, relational identity, where I and I is transrelational. I and I is, self and other self. Look everywhere in the mirror and all around, see the Creator. Everywhere you see, just the Creator. And the Creator is not impermanent. Boom. So if I could see, or when I see the river as a single body undulating, or a single body that appears to be moving because the background appears to be unmoving, because the background of the riverbed and the shore and the land here, and me and this body here, because this appears to be unmoving, that appears to be moving. Or that appears to be moving as this appears to be unmoving, and I appear to be here and not there. Uh-huh. Okay. That's all Maya. It's relatively true, but essentially empty. Now we have a lot of bird action. And the birds here are really, you know, this is the real jungle, not the human artifact. So these are birds I've never seen before, strange-looking fellows. and creatures free in their natural environment, which is very nice. But anyway, Heraclitus saying, eyes, ears, mind, and action, that's what I value, is right, I'd say, at the heart of some of the best of the Greek philosophical, classical Greek philosopher, philosophical tradition. Use mind well. Rational reason, the glory of reason, the glory and precious divine function faculty of reason, which just means think clearly, logically, but intuitively. Don't be a goofball who says that's impossible. Well, if it's so, it ain't impossible, dummy. And so there are a lot of dumbos around who will say, it's impossible! It can't be! Why, bro? Because you know everything? Are you omniscient? So, unfortunately, if you think that way, or, you know, if you can address shallow thinkers, eventually they won't come anywhere near you. So, and it's not like I'm saying, I'm a deep thinker! No, I'd love to know deeply. That's all. You know, hit the nail on the head until it's gone. Right. You got to keep hitting the same nail on the head until it disappears. Hello. Another bird. Black and white, and butterflies are also coming near. It's interesting. The longer I stay in this place, the more small creatures draw near. This will become another way station for forest traffic. So anyway, yes, Heraclitus, at the heart of the best of the Greek classical philosophical tradition, valued truly reason. Mind in action equals reason. Mind in action, using reason upon what? Using reason upon that which is received by eyes and ears. What else? How else do we receive input? Eyes and ears. 5.4, 5.2, both are stereoscopic, meaning dualistic, meaning dual configuration. I have a dual CPU called two eyes and two ears. That's the mandala of the head. the mandala of mind is the dual you know, double-barreled eyes and double-barreled ears, 5.4, 5.5, in duplicate, i.e. a tetrad, a quadratic formula for perceptual reception. So perceptual reception means receiving by perception, okay? That's what perception does, duh. So, but the key is that that's the way to knowing. But it's not the same as thinking. It's the input for thinking, or reason. So I look at the river, a river runs through it, yep. I may perceive it in motion, with a front and a middle and a back, a coming at me, and a front in front of me, and leaving away from me. But if I stand back and see the whole, I may sense that it's not moving, it's dancing light, it's a form of matter, obviously, with very close relations, by the way. I mean, the water really is a happy, they really have camaraderie, the water molecules, they're naturally attractive, the gravitational, I guess not gravitational, electrogravitic force that binds H2O to H2O, there's some term for that, is very durable, and water is a very close community. They're very, it's basically matter on the move. Earth-based matter on the move. it's melted earth. Basically, melted earth is water. And sublimated water is air. And the agent of destruction or transformation or transubstantiation, of course, is fire. And Heraclitus knew that. Fire as the mother of all, or conflict as the mother of all, war, conflict, fire as that which... Hello, another one. That which generates transformation. Earth... Now you'll see Heraclitus, channeling Heraclitus. Earth is melted by fire, becoming water. Water is transubstantiated by fire, becoming air. And look at, I watched, oh, time, 3033. Okay. 3033 is the time I checked. Speaking of fire as the force of transubstantiation, changing, melting earth to water and evaporating water to air, I watched the censored, unaired precursor to Threads. So if you want to talk about end-of-the-world nuclear destruction movies, we've got quite a few to choose from. We've got the TV show Jericho. Hello. A lot of big fellows coming nearby now. Jericho. Revolution, not quite, but Revolution is a grid-down, you know, EMP-type disabling of global electrical action, like an EMP before a nuke, without the nuke, which has the same kind of effect, except it's less destructive in the TV show Revolution. But you've currently got the TV movie called The Day After. Before that was a British version, much more gory and horrifying, called Threads. That was the compromise deal between the BBC and the directors and producer of something that was made prior called War Game. The War Game. 1966, I believe. That's even more horrible than Threads. Because it basically, it's a mock documentary of the UK post-nuclear destruction, where commentary, you know, professorial commentary goes along the way and interviewing people on the street after the nuclear devastation. So it's acted, but it's so horrifying that weak acting doesn't matter, because the theme and the setting is so strong and well done, but horrible. And the big killer there is fire, you know. So will this age end by water or fire? Well, probably by light, by solar light. But there may be a bunch of human-made fire before. So this group, you know, now we're going down into the bad neighborhood. There are too many negatives here, and it may well be nearly 50% Maldek. That's actually shocking from the timeline cosmology yesterday as we move along. I had underestimated, and I still don't have a final understanding, but I had underestimated the percentage of human population from Maldek, thinking it only 10% or something, and it may be, I just don't know. This is a real intricacy. But the population of Maldek, the population of Earth, Ra seems to indicate was half of Maldek in 1980, you know, 81, 82, when Don asked the question. So if the population at that time was half Maldek, then maybe it's still half Maldek today or something like that. That's a shitty influence, I must say. So it's no surprise that they feel comfort, temporary comfort, in armament and militarization and militarizing the negatives. The negative political leaders militarize their nations because it makes them feel good, actually. And they make money. but they feel safe, bristling with weapons. Likewise, many people in relationship make trouble for each other. There are a lot of troublemakers. Even if we, by mistake, sometimes make trouble, and even we, by mistake, make trouble, and sometimes we have negative desires, selfish desires, of course. We're not finished with selfish desire, and that's why there's any association with others in general. We're not there, you know, only for some kind of selfless service, if we are at all. People do relationship based on desire. Gautama said it straight up in Kagavisana Sutta. People associate for a motive. Yeah, of course. All behavior is motivated by desire of some sort, for some things, in some ways that the person only knows a bit of. So desire is the motive leading to association or relationship or group life or inclusion or relatedness or partnership or marriage and family. Okay, no problem. Desire. Desire makes conflict inevitably where others have their own desires that are not compatible or are dissonant. So we get into trouble, we make trouble. Some people walk around everywhere making trouble. There's a whole lot of interpersonal conflict because the people are not that different from the leaders. The corrupt, dishonest leaders who love power and love to bristle with weapons and defense, actually, are not so different than the people they oppress because the lower and middle classes economically, characterologically, morally, are not so much different than their leaders. Okay? And, you know, the mind in action doesn't depend on much quiet seeing and hearing. Quiet seeing and hearing leads to a successful mind in action. Meaning, one may successfully come to conclusions and understanding, deeper knowing, deeper peace from the knowing, by right use of mind, reason, logic, and intuition, rational, intuitive, both, based utilization of, processing of, the catalyst of what we see and hear. Because that's what it comes down to, seeing and hearing, all day long, seeing and hearing, seeing and hearing. I see the environment, and talk about that river that's moving and not moving, many and one, undulating even and not. You know, the environment that appears stationary is undulating too. It's just that my doors of perception have not been cleansed sufficiently to see the undulating, apparently motionless background to the apparently moving river, actually. So, all right, that's something to consider. Whether the cycle ends with water or fire or light, I don't know. It's long past the time when we should have recognized that we can't really, by talking, help most people much at all. By teaching or sharing our ideas or sharing what we believe in or sharing what we value by dialogue or discussion, that won't work with nearly all the people that we see and hear. Kindness, friendliness always works as a moment of kindness and friendliness and care that they'll receive or experience with us to the extent that we're there in that sincerely. That's nice, but the wanderers, you know, I think, although we can be of service to some of the people around us to some degree, in general, we're really here to learn and grow and radiate love light to the degree that we've become balanced. You know, the wanderers, somebody sent me an email, you got to keep hitting the same nail. Just because you hit the nail in doesn't mean it's finished. You stop hitting the nail when the nail disappears. That's when you stop hammering. You stop hammering the nail when there's no longer a nail. Hammer it till it dissolves. Meaning one can stay on a certain point. One really ought to stay on a certain point until it's just fully, you know, the flower has fully opened, blossomed. It's finished opening. Like the nail disappearing. There's nothing more to consider. What? What am I talking about? Well, somebody sent me an email about, you know, his, her life purpose or experience in the world, saying something like, well, you know, we're just here to experience and to, you know, to live on Earth. We're just on Earth to experience living on Earth. That's not true at all. Not at all. We're not here just to be here. There is a piece of work intended for which we're here, intended to be done for which we came here. But it doesn't necessarily mean starting a movement or attracting followers or extended dialogue or metaphysical teaching or sharing with anybody. But there is a piece of work to do. And we're not just here to have a good time or enjoy life on Earth and let's just experience Earth and see how it is. Okay, I come here to see how it is. Oh, that's not commonly the purpose of Wanderer's incarnation. Even a fifth density Wanderer that is in many ways very much here to observe and learn. Like my friend said, he calls himself a data collector, and he knows himself as 5D Wanderer. True. It's a certain kind of data. It's a certain kind of seeing and hearing. It's a certain kind of mind in action processing of a certain kind of seeing and hearing. Not the same as just, I'm here to experience life on Earth. I'm on Earth to experience life on Earth. That's it. There's no purpose. Oh, really? You know totality? Is that why you know there's no purpose? Uh-huh. You know, you got to knock people down so they can see that they're on a three-legged stool. Well, get the fourth leg after your stool falls, and you'll see. Actually, we're not just here to take it easy or have fun or, you know, I'm a spirit doing a human being for the heck of it? No, not at all. This is a very special 3D cycle. This is a very unusual situation. A deeper understanding of this situation, the human in the natural, the cultural, the human cultural, the depths of the distortions that infect these peoples, as Ross said, that is not well known in higher densities. Higher density beings do not know this profound tangle thicket, the thicket of distortion of Earth humanity. They don't know it well. Had they known it well, Tesla wouldn't have brought technology to be co-opted. A lot of things they did in terms of technology transfers would not be done, as far as I can tell. Now, the way they learn is by doing, or the way we learn also is by doing, commonly. You know, if you can't see through it, you got to see it through. If you can't know it, you probably have to do trial and error. Thus, they do the trial of technology transfers and experience the so-called error or the consequences, which is full negative co-optation. I don't think that would happen if they knew this group well. And so for some of us, this work is to know this group, to know this well, to know the human well. It helps to know the human well to be both in the human and get away from it regularly too. Like in rustic abodes. Rustic abodes are a good environment for processing that which we've seen and heard, to do mind action in mind, you know, effective action in mind upon what we've seen and heard while with humanity, after we've withdrawn apart from humanity. That's very important or very useful. But the importance of receptivity is, you know, that's what I mean by you gotta hammer the nail until it disappears. with a strong love of truth, one seeks deeper knowing. One recognizes shallow knowing, one's own shallow knowing, my shallow knowing. Thus I can see your shallow knowing, or a nail that hasn't been hammered in fully, or a nail that's still standing up, standing out, needs more hammering, is a shallow formulation. When you knock it down further, you get a deeper formulation, but it actually can go deeper. That's valuable. because in the end, one comes to peace. The end of knowing is peace, of course. The end of knowing is the freedom from desire for knowing. Because this knowing is dualistic still, meaning there's still a sense of subject-object. There's still perception. For as long as there's still self-consciousness or identity eighth fetter, you know, name and fame, the seeking of name and fame, or the assessment of name and fame, meaning this is my identity and this is my position, my fame, my status. This is me, second chakra. This is me in relation to you and the group and the world, my status, my name, my fame. The fame of my name, the status of my name is three, third chakra. So with second, third chakra blockages, which we all have, which are necessary, hello, a lot of bird action, we inevitably have dualistic knowing. And we may have insight, you know, breakthrough contact intelligent infinity or higher jhana states of unity or nothingness or, you know, boundlessness of mind or boundlessness of body or presence. Those are temporary states because we come back to the state of embodiment, which is inevitably, you know, dualistic unless one's finished with the seven chakra work. Okay? So we haven't. So we're in a dualistic knowing. But even dualistic knowing, which is illusory as dualism or subjectivity or the sense of a hardened subjective personhood, selfhood. Even that, when the nail is hammered deep and it starts to disappear, as far as I can tell, that knowing goes to peace. That knowing leads to less distress seeking greater knowing. I mean, why do we seek knowing? Because we have some degree of distress at not knowing. Everything's from polarity. The whole system is of polarity. The light is of polarity. The nature of light is polarity. The nature of all manifestation is polarity of light, light polarity. Time and space as well. Body and energy fields as well. Body, mind and spirit, inner and outer, past, present, and future, cycles, the whole thing is of polarity. And yet, coming to deeper knowing of any one matter that's essential, like self or dualism or phenomena, are they impermanent? Are they permanent? You see, actually, the teaching of impermanence is medicine for the sickness of presumed substantiality. Presumed substantiality means some sense of taking the impermanent as permanent, taking the non-abiding as abiding, taking the empty as solid, taking the river only as a thing. Then it can be broken down to see it as many things in continual motion. That's the benefit of seeing impermanence for the mind that hadn't yet seen it. It is some freedom from a certain fixity of perspective. And then the sensitivity to causality, of particularly impermanence is very useful in understanding causality. Because we're if we have any trouble or pain, it's useful to know how did this come about, which means what are the causal basis, what's the causal basis, and how did it come to be, or indecision, should I do this or should I do that? It's useful to know possible consequences, of course. So it's important to see, to acknowledge change and causality and influence and sequence. Very, very important. Yet, with less angst in mind and a more quiet seer, the change, the aspect of the change of the changeless, or the changeless can be seen in change, or the union of change and changelessness can be sensed. And that helps. But it doesn't necessarily help with daily life. But it does bring some peace to the mind. And that's important. So the basis of all that, again, and I'll conclude on this, is Heraclitus talking about his high valuing of eyes and ears and mind and action. Not speech. He didn't say, what I value, strong hands and sturdy feet and calves that can support my work and production of the essential. No, it wasn't even mouth. It was just eyes, ears, and mind and action. That's a contemplative. And that the contemplation of a contemplative or a true philosophia, a lover of wisdom, and other meanings, prioritizes learning, hearing, obviously seeing, hearing, and learning, thus knowing by action of mind. Seeing, hearing, thus muchly, greatly receptive to then be feeling and knowing by mind and action to some conclusions that bring peace, that are the knowing by the mind and action, working upon the very sensitized receiving eyes and ears. That knowing is helpful. It helps us find peace or discover the peace that is. And then we also can avoid difficult people and thus bad relationships and thus don't make decisions that we rightly see may likely have painful consequences. So that's that for today. And I hope this was useful. Thank you for listening. Again, I'll be back with the cosmology next week and free association lecture like this, not sure, but later. So take good care. Have a good weekend. Good night.